Boo Mitchell carries on the legacy of his legendary father, Willie Mitchell, as a premier producer of chart-topping hits. Boo's father is remembered and revered as a true pioneer of the Memphis soul sound. It was a partnership between Al Green and Willie Mitchell that created a home run hit back in 1971, followed by a number one hit every year for 4 years straight. One of Boo Mitchell's proudest achievements was taking home the Record of the Year Grammy in 2016. The first time in the history of the Grammy Awards that a Memphis-made record garnered the award. One of many amazing and distinctive nuances of the Royal Studios production facility today, instituted by Boo's father back in the 1960s and 70s, is its unabated, tenacious reliance on old-fashioned tube technology recording equipment, such as the 8-channel Ampex 351 reel-to-reel tape recorder, old-style mics, and more. Come along and join Boo Mitchell in the control room at Royal Studios, located in the heart of Memphis, Tennessee.
Hi, I'm Lawrence Boo Mitchell. I'm the owner manager of Royal Studios. I've been in the music business all my life.
You grew up in it, didn't you?
I grew up in it, yes.
Yeah. Tell us about your dad.
Willie Mitchell, my dad was Al Green's producer and all those high records, so I had a magical childhood growing up being in the studio with, you know, people like Al Green and Keith Richards and just all kinds of people.
But since you were born into it, that's what you knew. That was like your baseline, right? So it wasn't, oh my God, it was, oh, Al's here, right?
Yeah, exactly. We would do stuff like, you know, the Doobie Brothers would come to town and my dad would take them to, like, Piccadilly Cafeteria for lunch. You know, the Temptations would be in town. You know, they'd come to the house for dinner, sing happy birthday to the kids. And
But that was just intertwined into your daily life. So it wasn't as special as somebody looking from the outside, right?
Right, and being older, I have more of an appreciation for it now. You know, I look back, I was like, Jesus Christ, man, I'm hanging out with the Jacksons and, you know. So all this magical stuff that I didn't really, that seemed normal, you know. But I've grown to appreciate my childhood and, you know, the history of the studio and the legacy. That's why it's so important for me to preserve my father's legacy and the legacy of Royal Studios and to keep it going and to keep pushing the envelope.
Well, let's go back to Kiddom again. He was your dad and he'd kick your butt sometimes. So he wasn't a god in that sense, right?
Right. So a couple of times, yeah. Pop, it's like nobody wanted to disappoint him in the studio. That's why everybody, he got the nickname Pops, because he was like a father figure to everybody. And if you disappointed him, you felt worse than any butt whooping. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That was the punishment.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, he was just one of those figures that you wanted to please because he was such a loving and kind person. He was everything to me. I wanted to be just like him. I used to go to church and pray that I want to be an engineer, a producer, and a song. You know, I didn't know what it all meant at the time.
But you knew that's,
that's how I wanted to be, what my dad was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And here you are.
Here we are.
So in a way, he's still here, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You feel him,
Yeah. So, you know, you have what would Jesus do, and then I also have what would Papa do. So anytime I'm in the studio and, you know, I get stuck or something and get to a play, I just have to think, okay, what would Papa do?
So he's your default, yeah.
He's my default.
Yeah, looking over your shoulder.
Absolutely.
Tell us about when you first got it.
It kind of hit me maybe my junior year in high school that, okay, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. And I started out as a rapper in producing beats and stuff like that. And I did that for about 4 or 5 years. And then I started getting into producing other people and getting into the art of actually recording, engineering and stuff. So even when I got older and started being the engineer for my dad, that was like life-changing for me. just picking his brain, you know, we would drive home and I'd, you know, how did you mic this? What did you do? You know, when I got old enough and wise enough to ask the questions, because sometimes when you're a kid, you know, and you're like, okay, Pop did all this stuff, but we're trying to do this new stuff over here, and you don't realize what a treasure you have. So by the time I was about 30, it just kind of hit me, hey, this is an encyclopedia of musical knowledge that I can't get anywhere on the planet. And so I started picking his brain and asking him about, you know, chord progressions and how he mic'd things and just all kinds of stuff.
And you are pumping in a lot of different music all at once and balancing. That's an art in itself. Huge, isn't it?
Yeah, I grew up listening to everything. So, you know, when I would come home from school, I would listen to AC/DC and Rick James and SOS Band and, you know, Toto. So I was kind of
wide open.
Yeah, I was all over the place. So I just realized that I like good music, no matter what genre it is, you know. I've heard something in just about every genre that I like. So it makes me versatile as a producer and as an engineer because I really like the music that I make.
But you're wide open. To this day, a wide breadth of music comes in these doors, right?
Absolutely. We've done everybody from the Wu-Tang Clan to Robert Plant, just all different kind of genres of music.
And tell us about the journeys. One of the recent ones, how the guys sought you out and hunted you down. That's a great story.
Well, I did Mark Ronson's Uptown Special album that has the hit Uptown Funk. That was a session that kind of changed my life.
You didn't know it going in, did you?
No, I knew something. I had a feeling about, once I figured out how to spell Mark's name and could Google him properly, because he came here looking for singers, and the person that set up the meeting for him to come here and hear these people sing, I never really caught the name. You know, I was like, what did she say his name was? And so once I figured, I was like, oh, this dude is awesome. You know, he's made some of my favorite records. And he had never been to Royal. And when he walked in, you know, he was just really inspired by the room. He said, he has the best description of Royal Studios. He said, the room makes you feel like playing music.
Let's do a word picture of the studios, because it's not what somebody would think. I mean, this is like a archive of history here. It's unchanged. This is stuff that your dad did, right?
Yeah, it's unchanged since 69. My dad, he put up fiberglass insulation and burlap. He wanted his records to sound different, basically. And he wanted to, you know, you had the Motown sound and these other sounds, and he wanted to go the complete opposite direction. So he was quieting his room, and it's still the same, you know, the orange burlap, the green burlap,
the cedar shingles.
Mm-hmm. And it affects the room. You know, Al Green's Tired of Being Alone was the first record that he recorded with the perfected Willie Mitchell configuration. And you can listen to records that came out on Higher Records before then, and you can hear the evolution of the sound until it gets to that signature sound, you know, that you know.
And let's talk about even here at the control room we're sitting in, that you did recording in here with a $79 mic. That's a great story.
Yeah, so when Bruno Mars was here, they were working on Uptown Funk, and they were writing it, and we were up all night. Came time for him to do the vocal, so we put him in the vocal booth, obviously, with, you know, $20,000 mic. And me and his some of his bandmates were in the control room, and we were kind of dancing and, you know, having a good time while he was singing. And he goes, hey, I want to do the vocal in there with you guys. And I was like, oh, crap, that's an engineer's nightmare to do a vocal in the control room. So all I could think of was, like, SM57.
Why? I mean, it's like a $100 mic.
Because it won't feed back Okay. You know, in the control room, there's no headphones in here. The music's pumping out of the speakers. So you have to have a mic that is not really sensitive and it's not going to feed back. And the 57 is perfect for that. And so he did the vocal, and I just knew they were going to replace it. And his engineer, Charles, called me about a week after. He goes, "You know the vocal we did on the SM57? I was like, "Yeah." He said, "You know we're keeping that." Really? It's like, okay. And it sounds great, and it won me a Grammy, so thank you, Shure.
What a paradox, isn't it? And your board here, I mean, this is a...
Okay, so this board came from Compass Point Studios in the Bahamas.
It looks like 70s.
It's a 77 vintage. It's an MCI 536. And some of my favorite rock records were made on this board, like Back in Black. And my dad, once he got it here, he, like, had all a bunch of, you know, had it recapped and op amps changed, because he doesn't like factory anything. But this board, it has a unique sound. That's another thing. When Mark Ronson came in, he looked at the desk and he goes, "Oh, I've got the same board. I remember I bought it because I read your dad had it." it sounds amazing, man.
You've got tube technology here, 8-track Ampex that's probably the same vintage, and you still use a lot of that stuff.
Absolutely. I'm really into vintage, and I'm into, even my approach to music is kind of bridging the gap with old gear and new stuff, and old stuff. You know, my whole existence is based off of legacy and history. And, you know, that's my strength to go to the future. I have lots of the Ampex 8-track. It's not a factory thing. My dad had somebody make it. When 8-tracks came out, the 8-track tape recorders were all solid state. And Papa had one for about a week and decided that it sounded like crap. So some guy in Texas made him an all-tube 8-track tape recorder. So it's 8 Ampex 351 head stacks, and, you know, retrofitted on an 8-track tape machine.
I guess it goes the same reason that vinyl's coming back, right?
Oh, absolutely. Because all of these, there's something about electromagnetism that affects your body different when you listen to an MP3 and you listen to a vinyl or a cassette. It's something about the analog. It feels different, and people are realizing that. And, you know, I had to buy my daughter a turntable, and, you know, she gets records every week. She's 17, and she just turned 18, but she would call them vinyls. "Dad, I want some vinyls." I was like, "Don't say that. Don't say vinyls." But, you know, here's this kid, and she came down to the studio and just raided my record collection. So, yeah, vinyl is back with the passion.
That's so cool. Back to the studio and some of the coolest people that have come through your door that have been most touching experiences for you.
Oh, my God. Well, Al Green, obviously. Another life-changing experience was Solomon Burke. We did his last record. It was his last record and my dad's last record. Melissa Etheridge.
She was here not too long ago, right?
Yeah, Melissa was here last year. She did her record that's out now, Memphis Rock and Soul, and it was absolutely amazing. Melissa's guitar, she's got this guitar tone I've been trying to get all my life, and she came in and plugged her guitar up, and I was like, "Oh, that's it. That's what I've been trying."
Can we play a snippet of her?
Yeah, absolutely.
This album is out now, or?
Yes. It's called Memphis Rock and Soul, and it's all Stax covers. It's the songs that inspired her to do music.
And how did she find you? Why did she come here?
She knew she wanted to make the record in Memphis, and she courted, you know, some different studios. And I really think my aunt's pound cake is what sealed the deal. We'll be right back.
with a smile on your face. You loved engineering that.
Oh, my God. It was, that record was so fun to make. John Burke, the president of Concord, produced the record. And I've always wanted to work with John. I knew him from seeing him at Grammy functions and stuff. And I was like, that dude is cool. You know, he's just like, he has one of those, you know, this energy that just like, he's a cool guy, you know. And he did that brilliant record, Ray Charles, Genius Loves Company. So I've always wanted to work with John. And, you know, when we got the call about Melissa and John, too, so it was like a double whammy for me. You know, one of my favorite singers and one of my favorite producers. So.
Together.
Together, yeah.
Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I see you're a Grammy Award winner, aren't you?
Yes. I won a Grammy for Uptown Funk.
So tell us that story. That must have been just so sweet for you.
It was... So I've been going to... I'm really active in the Memphis Grammy chapter. I've been a chapter president, and I'm still a board member. And so I go to the Grammys every year, and, you know, I vote. And so I remember waking up and looking at the online ballot and seeing my name. And I was like, so I called my the executive director, and I said, John, man, my name is on the Grammy website. I was like, does this mean I don't have to buy my tickets this year?
That's so cool.
He was like, yep, that's exactly what that means. It's like, cool.
I love it. Yeah. So that sweet moment for you.
Absolutely. Life-changing. And even to the event, you know, people are like, are you going to go on stage? And I was like, you know, if I hear my name, yeah. And, everybody's like, you're going to win. And, you know, I never like to count my chickens before they hatch. You know, I knew the record was a really strong record, and when they announced it, it was like breathtaking. And then they started calling names, and as soon as I heard Boo Mitchell, I don't think I've ever ran that fast in my life.
Was it kind of like a dream? You're kind of surreal.
It was completely surreal. Yeah. And you know, the record of the year, if you can believe it or not, there's never been a record made in Memphis to win that award. It's like, it's the last award of the night. It's kind of like the pinnacle of all the Grammys. And, you know, Memphis Records, I think Shaft was nominated for Record of the Year in 72, but there's no record that's, you know, from Memphis ever actually won the award. So
nice.
It kind of felt, you know, it's like I was doing it for my city.
Exactly. I mean? Yeah. That's what I was thinking as you're talking. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we access it on your board? Yeah. Is it? Yeah. Absolutely love it. And the Grammy again was for?
Uptown Funk Record of the Year.
Nice. That's not bad.
Not too shabby at all.
I love it. Boo, I'm bummed, man. I got to say goodbye. I could keep you captive here for another hour, man.
thank you, man. I appreciate you coming in. It's a big year for Royal Studios. It's our 60th year. So we're celebrating our 60th anniversary this year. We've been making music since 1957.
I love it, with 1960s technology.
Exactly.
So sweet.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Once again, Boo Williams, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Memphis, Tennessee. We'll see you here. I'm so
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory, produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Since we've been together, ooh, loving you forever is what I need. Let me be the one you come running to. I'll never be. Just can't.